are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, April 30th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, professor of history at Northwestern University, Daniel Immerwahr, on how to hide an empire, a history of the greater United States. Also on the program today, impeachment talk increases as Trump stonewalling increases, including a lawsuit against Deutsche Bank and Capital One to block release of financial records to Congress. Also on the program today, Trump to charge refugees fees for asylum. Rod Rosenstein resigns, praising Donald Trump's good humor. And Mike Pompeo praises our involvement in the Yemen slaughter. Meanwhile, Joe Biden staking out the Republican lane in the Democratic primary. And Democrats fight to maintain the promise of loan relief for public workers. And in Ohio, Ohio Republicans remind us that the problem is Republicans. And lastly, the U.S. cheers on an attempted coup going down right about now in Venezuela. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the program. Everyone's here today. Jamie is back from her. Where did you go, Jamie?
First, I went upstate to work on my book proposal and freak out about that. And then I went to the 24-hour drone festival, which was, as always, a transcendent experience.
I don't even know what that means. What does that mean?
Drone music?
Oh, okay.
It's like repeating tone.
I thought you were saying.
Not the kind that fly in the sky.
I think you made the same mistake last year, actually.
I did?
Yeah.
I guess I didn't pick up that. Where is the drone? Where is the drone festival?
It's at Basilica Hudson, which is a beautiful former factory building owned by Melissa Auftermaar and her filmmaker husband.
I know that place very, very well.
Cool.
My daughter has gone to camp right next to the Basilica.
Oh my God!
Yeah, I didn't realize
this one. My experience was not for kids. I'll tell you that much. This past weekend,
I can only imagine.
Not for beginners.
I can only imagine. All right, folks. Couple of emails I got from listeners that I want to share with you because longtime listeners, both. One is from listener Alex. Hey, I'm Mark Crew. It's my brother's Spencer's birthday, and I was hoping you could give him a shofar. He did the same for my birthday, and it made my day. We are both daily listeners and members. He was going to get me a membership for my birthday, but found out I had already joined. Keep fighting the good fight, pajama boys and girls. Left is best. And I'm going to combine that shofar with one from Filmfest guy, longtime listener, associated with the film archives. Could I have a birthday shout out? It was my 50th this past Saturday. Welcome to it, buddy. And to both you guys, happy birthday. Thanks for your continued listenership. Much appreciated. All right, let's go to this. Ben Shapiro, still on the... it seems like every week he's got a new favorite freshman woman congressperson that he is obsessing about.
I think Ilhan's his favorite.
Ilhan is his favorite now. Well, because, you know, in the attempt to deny the obvious truth that hate crimes against Muslims, against Jews, against really anybody who is not white in this country or not Christian, has gone up since the entrance into the race by Donald Trump. And the Republican Party, which enabled Donald Trump's rise, which trained its electorate to vote for a guy like this, that has excused time and time again rhetoric that ranges from, I'm sure there's some decent non-rapist Mexicans, to, you know, we're going to ban Muslim countries, Muslim immigrants, to just, we're going to charge refugees money if they're seeking asylum, and on and on and on. I'm sure there are good people on both sides, the whole thing. In their desperate attempt to hide their and deny their own complicity in this stuff, whether they dress it up as like, we're just exploring ideas here. We're rebels. We're talking about stuff that was, you know, hasn't been as popular since we were talking about eugenics or something. They are constantly looking for other people to blame for what they know ultimately is a function of their politics. And here is Ben Shapiro trying to somehow tie Ilhan Omar into the white supremacist who shot up a synagogue a couple of days ago.
As I said before, if you are blind to anti-Semitism from one particular side of the aisle because it favors your political position, you are not in the fight against anti-Semitism. You're part of the problem. If anti-Semitism is just another political club to be wielded, if Ilhan Omar...
Pause it. You know, it's just amazing because like, one could be forgiven for assuming that that was the way he was about to introduce his apology. When anti-Semitism is just simply used as a political club. And with that said, I had an epiphany last night and I'm going to retire and I'm going to go work somewhere else and do something else with my life because I realize what I have been doing has been so wrong. But instead, he turns to Ilhan Omar.
You're part of the problem. If anti-Semitism is just another political club to be wielded, if Ilhan Omar is given the credibility to speak out against anti-Semitism while routinely engaging in anti-Semitism, she has a lot of the same opinions about Jews that the white supremacist had in that manifesto. In that manifesto, the shooter basically says, effectively says about Jews that they control the world media, that they control the way money runs, that they control opinion about Israel. Am I going to
pause it? Pause it. Now, Ilhan Omar has said none of those things. None of the things she's ever said could even be remotely interpreted by that. The closest she's ever said is that the PAC that is has in its mission statement to impact the public opinion of Israel in this country does it by expending money on candidates. Just like Thomas Friedman said, although Thomas Friedman said it a little more aggressively and a little more pointedly and a little bit more studiously. But she never said any of the things he's lying about now. So just think how decrepit you have to be in your brain to make this case that we shouldn't politicize anti-Semitism as you are lying to politicize anti-Semitism and basically comparing Ilhan Omar to a white supremacist who's just shot somebody up because, and he has to lie about the similarities in their manifesto. And I want you to keep that in mind. We don't need to hear Ben Shapiro anymore because Ben Shapiro, when we talk about manifestos, when we talk about the implications, and I don't know what the point is he's making that Ilhan Omar, and he lies about her opinions, are similar to those of the shooter. But we know for a fact that the guy who shot up In Canada, which number is this one that we have here? The Quebec City mosque shooter. In the Washington Post, the guy's name, Bisonette, appears to have obsessively visited the Twitter accounts of Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham, David Duke, Alex Jones, Mike Cernovich, Richard Spencer, and Bisonette checked on the Twitter account of Ben Shapiro 93 times in the month leading up to the shooting. So if you want to talk about similarities in perspective, if you want to talk about inspiration for attacks like these, here's a video. Who did this video?
This is a clip from Vic Berger.
Vic Berger did a video comparing the rhetoric from Shapiro with the testimony, not the testimony, the interrogation of this guy Bisonette. Listen to this.
Many Muslims are trying to kill Jews. End of story. This idea, we are all Muslim. No, we aren't. And the only people who think we are leftists who are fully insane, or Muslims who believe that we all should be Muslims and that they get to kill us if we disagree. So all of this politically correct nonsense, it's going to get a lot of people killed.
They're coming for Western civilization.
A lot more people will die because there are people who believe we are all Muslims.
Here's Bisonette. I wanted to save people. Save people, they ask? Yes. From terrorist attacks.
How many Americans have died for this crap?
I mean, I don't know if I can say that Shapiro inspired this guy, but we do know in terms of factually, this guy was obsessively checking the messages he was getting from Shapiro, and that his perspective, his fears, were completely aligned with the warnings that Shapiro was giving. It's really stunning for this guy to come out and say this type of stuff.
If we're talking about manifestos, I actually read the one from the New Zealand guy, and I would like to see Ben Shapiro explicitly say how his views on the dangers of Muslim immigration differ from those expressed in those manifestos.
That would be very interesting to hear.
I mean, it's pretty shocking to hear Ben Shapiro going out and trying to make this argument.
Yeah, and he can stop using all Jews as an excuse, by the way, because most Jews do not agree with him.
Well, he would not, to be fair, he would not consider those Jews to be Jews. Because Ben Shapiro, completely inconsistent with the with Jewish tradition, feels that he is the Pope of the Jews, apparently.
I'm the Pope of the Jews.
Or he certainly, it appears, to act that way.
And a most piousist.
Folks, reminder, New Yorker magazine represents the best writing in America today. Both online and in print, the New Yorker covers a full range of topics, including politics, news, international affairs, climate change, popular culture, the arts, fiction, food, humor, cartoons. Not to mention, the New Yorker touches on subjects that many readers may not have previously put much thought into, like the world's diminishing supply of sand. Or paper jams, or stink bugs. I think about stink bugs quite a bit, actually. Hunting down heirloom beans. Some of the New Yorker's incredible writers include contributors like Ronan Farrow, who broke the news on Harvey Weinstein and Les Moonves. And Helen Rosner, a James Beard Award-winning food writer, contributes essays and reports stories on all things gastronomic. We spoke about a New Yorker story yesterday involving the grift that is the NRA. You can go check out a profile on John Bolton that's in the piece now. Basically, Bolton's attempt to sell Donald Trump on neoconservatism again. There's a piece on the return of al-Baghdadi from ISIS. Billionaires and Jack Dorsey's TED interview. That's the guy from Twitter.
That was very informational.
I bet.
Extremely so.
We're all in good hands.
Yeah, exactly. Everything's going to be fine. Anyways, If you're not reading The New Yorker, you're not reading anything, frankly. And now our listeners can save 50% and get 12 weeks of The New Yorker for just $6 when you go to newyorker.com/majority and enter the coupon code majority. You also get an exclusive tote, as well as unlimited access to The New Yorker's apps, online archive, crossword puzzle, and newyorker.com with 10 to 15 exclusive site-only stories every day. That's newyorker.com/majority. Enter majority. 50% off. 12 weeks in The New Yorker for just $6. Give me a break. Also, as you know, Third Love, a sponsor of this program. They have more than 70 sizes, including their signature half cup sizes. Third Love designs bras with breast size and shape in mind for a perfect fit, premium feel. You just answer a few simple questions via Third Love's Fit Finder quiz to find your perfect fit in 60 seconds. Then, thanks to Third Love's 100% fit guarantee, you can wear, wash, and put your bra to the test for 60 days. And if you don't love it, you can return it, and Third Love will wash it and donate it to a woman in need. This is hands down the most comfortable bra you'll own. Our official tester writes, the fit is great. I usually have to return most bras I order online. Even though they're in my size, I ordered two and both fit. That almost never happens. Super comfortable for an everyday bra, but not as boring as most t-shirt bras. Subtle, cute details, so I don't feel basic. They have straps that won't slip, tagless labels, lightweight, super thin memory foam cups. Not to mention, they have a new line of incredibly soft, smooth, and breathable cotton bras. Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everyone, so right now they're offering my listeners 15% off your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/majority now to find your perfect fitting bra and get 15% off your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/majority for 15% off today. And lastly, Mother's Day is coming up, and there's nothing we wouldn't do to make sure the special moms in our lives are happy. Shari's Berries has a special Mother's Day berries designed just for mom. They're topped with chocolate chips, pink shimmer sugar, and swizzles. They're beautiful, folks. And you choose your delivery date to ensure that mom gets you your gift to Shari Berries exactly when you want her to. Better yet, your satisfaction is always guaranteed. Folks, we've gotten many shipments of Shari's Berries here. I'm literally...
Yeah, maybe someday I'll get to try one before maybe. You eat them
I
all.
I like
maybe,
them so
maybe,
much.
Maybe.
Hello.
I do have a bit of a problem with eating just one of them. They are delicious, and I wish I had more right now. But it's a great gift for mom. Don't wait to the last minute on this one, folks. Visit berries.com to order freshly dipped strawberries starting at $19.99 for moms in your life. And you can determine when they get delivered. So do it today so you don't forget. You only got about 10 days until Mother's Day. Less. Wait, what's today? No, about 10 days. 12 days. To make mom really happy, you can double the berries for just $10 more. Mother's Day is Sunday, May 12th. So visit berries.com. That's berries.com. Then click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner. Enter my code CEDAR. As in Seder, as in S-E-D-E-R, that's berries.com. Click on the microphone, code CEDAR, S-E-D-E-R. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Daniel Immerwahr on his book titled, right here, How to Hide an Empire, A History of the Greater United States. We'll be right back.
You are having a
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor of History at Northwestern University, Daniel Immerwahr, author of How to Hide an Empire, A History of the Greater United States. Daniel, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. So let's just as an overview, this is almost a geographic history of the empire of the United States. What is it about knowing the geography as you track it over the course of a couple hundred years that is so important to our understanding of America as an entity, I guess?
Yeah, no, that's right. I start the book with maps, and one of the reasons I do that is that, frankly, I think a lot of people in the United States and a lot of people outside of the United States don't really have an accurate map of the full borders of the country in their head. So, you know, if you ask most people, what does the U.S. look like on a map? They call to mind that familiar shape, just the contiguous blob with Mexico and Canada on the north and south and the oceans on either side. But the thing is, those have only been the borders of the United States for 3 years of its history. There's 3 years of U.S. history where those are the borders, partly because in the 18th and early 19th century, the United States was expanding. But because after it stopped sort of expanding in the contiguous North America, it started expanding overseas, taking first uninhabited islands in the Caribbean and the Pacific, and then, you know, taking large inhabited colonies. By the end of the 19th century, it had a very large and populous empire. And those overseas parts of the United States, both the colonies and then later on the military bases, hundreds of them that the United States claims, those are, I think, just don't really feature in most people's maps of the country. And as a result, they tell a truncated version of its history, a history that only is interested and only focuses on the mainland. And they miss a lot of the action when they do that.
And does it and do we also does it have implications in terms of the character of the country? I mean, that we don't fully grasp the history, but do we not fully grasp, you know, I guess the. I don't know. I'm just thinking, you know, we're obviously it's primary season. And so we have a lot of candidates who talk about America as an idea. I'm not sure I 100% know what that means. But does it implicate that idea?
I think it does, because the vision that you get of the United States, if you're just looking at what people in the territories call the mainland, first of all, it's a vision where Republican ideals hold not perfectly, but fairly well. Most people live in parts of the United States that allow them to vote, that allow them to have vote for representatives in Congress. Now, that's not true in D.C., so there are some little anomalies, and Native American lands have their own sort of legal arrangements. Nevertheless, you kind of feel like it's wall-to-wall carpeting in terms of the Republican system. Once you look at the other parts of the United States, the overseas parts, you realize that a big part of U.S. history is a peripheral zone, a zone that doesn't have representation in terms of the ability to vote for the president, doesn't have the ability to vote for delegates who then have voting power in Congress, and in many cases isn't even covered by the Constitution. So that's disenfranchisement or subordination by all three modes of government. And that is, I think, a serious cognitive dissonance or contradiction between the ideals of the country as we often articulate them and the ideals as they're actually lived.
I mean, I guess, and as we go through these sort of these eras, I mean, do we have an accounting of, particularly in that respect, of the numbers that we're talking about? I mean, how does that translate at maybe high and low points in terms of just how many of those of people are in that sort of that area of they're not sovereign, but they're not in any way represented?
Sure. So we're at a relative low point right now. The United States still has 5 inhabited territories, and between 3 and 4 million people live in them. If you add Washington, D.C., that's, a few more 100,000 people without full representation, the kind that citizens living in states have. But, you know, that's a relatively low point. If you go back to 1940, which is where I sort of open the book as I tell the story of how World War II comes to the territories. At that time, 19 million people who live in the United States, 19 million people who are U.S. nationals live off the mainland outside of the states. And just for some perspective, if you live in the United States, then there's a 1 in 8 chance that you're colonized, that you live in the territories, which means that you're more likely to be colonized than you are to be an immigrant. You're more likely to be colonized than you are to be African-American by odds of 3 to 2. So this has been, at various points, a very substantial part of the United States' population. And even at times when, even in places where the populations are kind of low, small islands, military bases, which are relatively small enclaves, those spaces have also been really important to U.S. history beyond their effect of the people who live in them or right around them.
I want to start with Pearl Harbor and the story you tell about FDR and the way that he was sort of framing this for the estates. But it occurs to me as you're saying that about that sort of the really stunning number of people who are, you know, I mean, disenfranchised is almost like an underwhelming word in that context. When we add that with slavery, which where you had people obviously in probably material situations, perhaps even more oppressed, but certainly the number of we have had in an expansive history of having dominion or control over people without their having any participation in what we perceive as the idea of America, that has been sort of more the norm than not.
Yeah, well, certainly it's been throughout U.S. history, every, you know, day of U.S. history, there's some version of this going on. You can find some moment when the promises made turn out to be restricted to, you know, in the 18th and 19th century to a white settler population rather than to the full population of all the land in North America, which includes Native Americans, which includes enslaved African Americans. But what's really important to recognize, I think, is that colonialism is one of those important axes of subordination. Actually, it's a really big one. And so when we're talking about the ways in which people are disenfranchised or legally subordinated or sort of they don't count within the, sort of sense of Washington of who matters and who doesn't, actually colonialism is a fairly big chunk of that and certainly is so, especially in the first half of the 20th century.
So let's talk about the attack on Pearl Harbor, which in fact, I just found the whole thing sort of fascinating because I have always referred to it as the attack on Pearl Harbor, when in fact, in some respects, it was in terms of the war, it doesn't have the same relevance in terms of as all the other attacks that took place that day. But we don't have that in our consciousness the consciousness that Americans had of what constituted our territories at that time. Explain that.
Yeah, so Pearl Harbor is not really the best name for what happened. And the reason it's not the best name for what happened is that the attack began for the United States with an attack on the naval base Pearl Harbor in the territory of Hawaii, but it didn't stop there. In a near simultaneous attack, this all took place within hours. It's a little confusing because part of the attack took place on the other side of the international dateline, and therefore it happened on December 8th, but this is all happening within a single solar day. The Japan attacks of the U.S. territories, Hawaii, Wake Island, which is an not indigenously inhabited but nevertheless occupied territory, Guam, and the single largest territory that the United States had ever held, which is the Philippines. And the reason that Pearl Harbor is not a particularly great descriptor for all of that is, first of all, it's not clear that that's even where the greatest military damage is done. The damage to the Philippines is quite serious and takes out the sort of pillar of air defense in the entire Pacific. But more importantly, the attack on Pearl Harbor is just an attack, whereas the attack on Guam, Wake Island, the Philippines, and then later Alaska, this wasn't in that day, but it happened, you know, within months, was a Japanese attack followed by more attacks, followed by invasion and occupation. And so, you know, the largest colony that the United States had ever held, the Philippines, was occupied by Japan for years. It was a brutal occupation, and folks in the Philippines had a very different kind of war than people in Hawaii had.
In fact, by the end of World War II, Philippines had lost, what was it, 1.5 million people or
1.6? Okay, so it depends on how you count. If you're asking how many Filipinos died in the Second World War, the government count is around 1.1 million. If you ask how many people died in the Philippines, and that so includes Japanese and that includes U.S. mainland service members, then it goes up to 1.6 million. But just to clarify, that makes World War II in the Philippines the bloodiest event that ever took place on U.S. soil. That's two civil wars. And yet you rarely hear about this in U.S. history textbooks because the kind of U.S. history that we often do and teach in this country is a history of not the entire United States. It's a history of the mainland only. And so things that take place outside of the mainland don't seem to count as part of that history.
And talk about how FDR addressed the country, the United States, I guess the Americans, in sort of framing what happened on that day. And like, you know, I guess the question I have as you explain it is it simply because like, oh, this is not a teachable moment to explain how we've been, you know, how many territories we have? Or is it that this is not the vision that we have of ourselves? And so I don't want to really push that at this moment.
Yeah, so FDR faces a really interesting choice. And in fact, not just FDR. Anyone who's describing the attack that we now call Pearl Harbor, in those, you know, hours and days after it, is facing an interesting question, which is how to describe what happened. And we've got a term for it, Pearl Harbor. But they didn't have that term. That was the name of the military base, the naval base. But no one called the full attack Pearl Harbor in the way that we did. That didn't come out for a few days. So you can just go through the newspaper headlines and see editors try to put a descriptor to it or try to put a name to it or try to say what happened. And often they would say that, well, a lot of things happened. Japan attacked Hawaii and Guam, or Japan attacked the Philippines and Hawaii. It wasn't clear where the focus needed to be. Eleanor Roosevelt gave a speech the night before, so before FDR's date, which will live in infamy speech, and she focused attention on Hawaii and the Philippines. And that's also how the draft of FDR's famous speech went. FDR produced that draft, and it was about Japanese attacks on Hawaii and the Philippines. And then you can just see FDR noodling with the draft. And when I say you can see it, I mean literally, because we actually have his marked up successive copies and his emendations and his deletions. And one thing he does is he takes out prominent references to the Philippines. He makes this a story about Hawaii. There's still a sort of back page reference to the Philippines. People don't always remember in that speech there, FDR gives a list of other places that Japan has attacked. It's an indiscriminate list, so it doesn't distinguish in any way between U.S. and foreign territory, and it's sort of tucked to the back of the speech. But nevertheless, the focus of that is on Hawaii, and it seems pretty clear to me why. I don't think this is a sort of grand conspiracy, but I think what FDR is responding to is that there is very little support on the U.S. mainland for a military defense of the Philippines, which is has a very small white population, is very far from the mainland, or for Guam. And there's more support, although even that is kind of wobbly, to use the U.S. military to defend the territory of Hawaii, which has a larger, although not majority, white population. And you can see FDR worried about even Hawaii, because the final edit he makes to the speech between the last draft that we have on paper and his actual spoken speech is that he inserts the word American in there before he describes the target in Hawaii, just to really underscore to his audience, and I think FDR was nervous about what his audience would hear, that Hawaii might sound foreign, might feel foreign, but actually is American territory, and therefore a Japanese attack on it is a cause for war.
So, all right, so let's go back and What is the genesis of, I mean, the, I guess the genesis of the American Empire begins as settlers and colonialists start to move west, right? What is the genesis of this sort of lack of awareness. I mean, maybe this is like a generic shyness about being an empire, but it doesn't, you know, like it seems to me like the British Empire was sort of, you know, they were pretty psyched about making sure that everybody was aware that they were an empire. I don't get the same, you don't get the same sense of American history in that way.
Yeah. So two things. First of all, you're right that in some ways these questions of empire go back to day one, literally to day one, in that the right after the United States is formally independent from Britain. So the treaty has been ratified by both sides and now the country is independent. Its name is United States of America, which suggests that it's a union of states, but it's not. It's a union of, or it's not even a union, it's an amalgam of states and territories. The word union suggests voluntarily entered into. But the United States, from day one, has territories, in this case, Western territories, and will have territories every day, you know, until now. I mean, so every intervening day, it's always states and territories. But at first, that's not a hidden kind of thing about the United States. People are very aware of it. The Civil War has a lot to do with the battle for slavery in the territories. Candidates for president will talk about their sort of, you know, log cabin, you know, backcountry roots. I think the moment when the imperial architecture of the United States becomes the kind of thing that has to be hidden is when those territories are no longer receptacles for the filling up with white settlers, when they become large populous places full of people who are perceived from the perspective of the mainland as non-white and who can't just be dislodged by white settlers. And so we're talking here about territories like Puerto Rico, Hawaii, the Philippines, Alaska, Guam, and that kind of imperialism, the kind about you're ruling distant populations, the kind that Britain does so proudly, that's the kind that the United States never sort of or very rarely trumpets proudly. And for most of its history experiences a sort of cognitive dissonance about, you know, on the one hand, it has a vision of itself as, you know, a republic where everyone has sort of some say in the government. On the other hand, the reality is that, you know, millions of people live under this different kind of government. And that never quite fits in the same way that it fits easily into British political culture.
Is that what it is? It's because that reality butts up against the narrative of the character of America, of the idea of America. And is it that, and or is it also that this is about resource extraction or about some type of like, we need a base here?
Well, yeah, it's interesting that the story of the United States' overseas colonies is not largely a story of successful resource extraction. There are sugar plantations and pineapple plantations and such, but it's not like the United States depends for its absolute livelihood on its overseas territories. It does, in the later 20th century, start to care a lot about, you know, all of its military bases all over the planet. But why does it have large colonies? It doesn't really turn out to need them in some deep way. Nevertheless, there's a real contradiction between how the United States, which was born of an anti-colonial revolt, envisions itself, the kind of pattern that it had been in the 19th century, where it did, you know, states and territories, but it always, you know, or it intended to upgrade those territories to states once they were filled with large white populations, and then the kind of pattern that, you know, it acts out in the overseas territories, which doesn't quite fit that model, and therefore doesn't, you know, can't be part of the sort of or doesn't turn out to be part of the national myths of the country.
I want to start going through the history, but I'm sort of hung up on like so why was there so much of this? Like, what did we?
Well, so much of what?
Of maintenance of territories when we don't need the resources. Was it we need the markets? Was it the? I mean, because I know, you know, we have some dynamics where it's, you know, gives us a little like, it's almost like Guantanamo Bay on some level. That is a little bit extreme, but that's a model of what we use these territories for. Like, it's outside of the purview of the United States, but we still have control, so we can experiment with some stuff and maybe do stuff you know, quasi-legal, that type of thing.
Well, so Guantanamo Bay is a pretty good example of this because, you know, now we think of Guantanamo Bay as for the perspective of, you know, the United States and the national security apparatus, it has been a very useful space. It's this little part of Cuba that the United States has exclusive jurisdiction over, and jurisdiction that is so complete, it's as if it were a sovereign, but it's not a sovereign. And that difference between not quite technically being a sovereign is what allows all kinds of legal things to happen, or things that would be illegal if they were happening on U.S. soil. So you think of that as a very useful kind of space, but you have to realize that the United States had had Guantanamo Bay since the very early 20th century. And, you know, sometimes it had been genuinely really useful. Other times it had been a little less so. And there's a kind of history of experimentation. What can be done with it? Haitians who are, you know, coming to the U.S. mainland can be detained there. That's something that happens before it gets its present-day use. And I think a lot of the history of the U.S. colonial empire, as opposed to the history of the pointillist empire on the military bases, is a history of speculative desires. But desires that don't always pan out. So there's this great enthusiasm at the end of the 19th century for the United States becoming a big colonial empire, for having Hawaii and the Philippines, and these will be, highways to Asia and to trade with Japan and China. And that trade doesn't really become a huge thing. But nevertheless, in the same way that you can, you know, a couple can fall out of love but stay married, a country can grow less imperialist or sort of lose its initial imperialist desire and remain an empire. And I think that's the history of the U.S. colonies, at least in the early 20th century. They do have some kinds of uses for Washington, but they are not the most useful parts of the country. Nevertheless, they're still part of it, and a part of the country that is neglected, that lives in the shadows. But that could be a very weird part of the country to occupy.
Tell us a little bit how, like, the Guano Islands fall into that.
Please.
And that notion of appertaining, which I found fascinating.
Yeah. So what happens is there's an agricultural crisis in the United States in the mid-19th century. And the reason it's happening is kind of fairly predictable, is that if you grow food on a farm, again, you grow a cash crop, so it could be grain, it could be cotton, it could be tobacco, but if you grow it again and again on the same plot of land and you keep selling it somewhere else rather than consuming it nearby or consuming it on the land and then depositing the nutrients back in the land through feces or just, you know, by putting the waste back on the land, you end up depleting the soil. And particularly, you start running down the soil's nitrates, which are kind of hard to restore if you just keep, you know, doing that year after year. So farmers get really nervous about finding some way to replenish their parched farms. And the thing that does it is guano, which is, but guano can mean bird or bat feces used for fertilizer. But it turns out that this is the droppings of seabirds on these small dry islands that don't see a lot of rain, where the birds just land and, you know, they eat their anchovies and they land on the islands, and then they defecate on the islands, and then it just, you know, just keeps piling up for years, centuries, millennia, drying in the sun. That stuff is a really useful fertilizer. And so in the middle of the 19th century, this is actually the first U.S. overseas expansion, the United States lays claim to nearly 100 uninhabited guano islands and annexes them to the United States. And there's a Guano Island Act that's passed, and it says that these places will be, once they're sort of claimed and the claim is ratified, they'll be appertaining to the United States, which is a kind of a weird sort of language, but what it seems to say is that they're fully part of the United States. Now, that, just that phrase, appertaining to the United States, that's the legal foundation for the United States' overseas empire. That's the first time that the United States had annexed overseas territory. And there's a Supreme Court case about whether appertaining really, does that mean that these places are really part of the United States or not? And the Supreme Court decides yes. So these are just 100 small uninhabited islands. They're quickly scraped free of guano, and then after that, they're not as useful anymore. But nevertheless, they are the actual legal foundations for a much larger populous empire, one that includes, you know, up to 19 million people by the eve of World War II.
It's an amazing metaphor that our entire empire, the project of the empire, is literally built on mountains of crap. But
yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, and I'll just say one other thing. I mean, because we talked about the ways in which these places can be useful and then not have an obvious use from the perspective of Washington, but you know, sort of develop one a little later. Those guano islands, after the guano is scraped off of them, they sort of fall into disrepair or disuse. But then it turns out in the mid-20th century, for all of the reasons that they're interesting to birds as places to land, they're also really useful for places for airplanes to land. And then suddenly the guano islands become absolutely, or at least some of them, become absolutely essential to the U.S. military strategy. And it is with the guano islands that the United States fights World War II in the Pacific.
Interesting. And let's talk about, let's move to the early 1900s when the Supreme Court does sort of make a distinction between incorporated and unincorporated territories. What were the implications of that, and what how much staying power did that have?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting moment. So the United States has just acquired a number of populated territories. It's gutted Spain's empire in a war, and it's also taken Hawaii and American Samoa. And then there's this legal question of, well, what are these places? Are they part of the United States? And if so, how much are they part of the United States? You know, are people who live in them automatically citizens? There's a law, it's called the 14th Amendment, that says if you're born in the United States, you're a U.S. citizen. Does that apply to Filipinos? Does the rest of the Bill of Rights apply to Filipinos? So the Supreme Court argues it, and it's a contested thing. It's a very public thing, these arguments. And ultimately, what the Supreme Court decides is that there is a distinction, and this is a novel distinction. It wasn't one that had been around before, but the Supreme Court introduces it. There's a distinction between incorporated territories. Those territories are part of the United States in a constitutional sense. So those are the old Western territories. And they're also the two overseas territories that have the largest white populations, Hawaii, and the Supreme Court decides Alaska. But all of the territories that the United States had claimed from Spain, which is where most of its colonial subjects live, those, the Supreme Court decides, are unincorporated territories, which means that they are part of the United States, but they're not part of the United States that's covered by the Constitution. And so that's why even today you can be born in American Samoa. You're born in the United States. No one disputes that. You have a U.S. passport. The stars and flags, stars and stripes fly overhead. But nevertheless, your U.S. passport does not say you're a U.S. citizen because the 14th Amendment doesn't extend to you. You're a U.S. national instead.
I mean, to put it in context, this is the same Supreme Court that basically said literacy laws for voting were okay and poll taxes were okay. I mean, the agenda is pretty clear, right?
Yeah, and it's actually nearly identical to the court. I mean, there's, I think, one member different decides the first of these cases. They're called the Insular Cases, that also decides Plessy v. Ferguson, which is the case that enshrines separate but equal as of, you know, constitutional way of running the country, which administratively divides the country into two in terms of white and non-white. The Insular Cases do something similar. They divide the country into two in terms of a constitutional zone and an extra-constitutional zone, and they also do it appealing to exactly the same logic. You know, who's really part of the country and who's, for racial reasons, not quite really part of the country. The difference is this. Plessy v. Ferguson, I mean, that's recognized today as one of the sort of worst mistakes in the court's history, and it's been overturned. The Insular Cases are still good law.
Yeah, well, I mean, Plessy v. Ferguson, we could be just a couple of years away from that type of regime returning in some respects. Maybe I'm overstating the case maybe a little bit, but certainly the Lochner era may be back soon. But with that said, so this law, so how is it that, well, I mean, I guess it's quite obvious why it's so durable, right? Is because, why has that been so durable, I guess, is really what I'm asking. What were the forces that didn't allow Plessy v. Ferguson to stand, but allowed this to stand?
Yeah, I think one difference is that Jim Crow was obviously a form of racist subordination, but it was also fairly public. You know, it was hard to not know that the country had a Jim Crow system if you were living anywhere in the country in the 20th century. Nevertheless, it's been very easy not to really understand the colonial system or even the fact of overseas territories if you live in the mainland part of the United States or if you have lived there in the 20th and into the 21st century. So an example of this is even after Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico and, you know, laid waste to the infrastructure of the island, there was a, you know, and it made all the headlines, there was a national poll that asked people in the mainland, are Puerto Ricans U.S. citizens? And barely a majority of people, adults polled, were able to correctly say, yes, Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens. And if you asked adults under 30, only 37% of them were able to cough up that number. So I think one difference between the racist regime that had applied to African-Americans is it was very much in the public view, whereas the colonial forms of subordination and segregation, those have kind of happened off stage, at least off stage from the perspective of the mainland.
Since we're talking about Puerto Rico, tell us the story of Cornelius Rhodes, because that is, you know, we've talked on this program, you know, that of the long history that the United States has had that in many respects is really one of, you know, almost waging some type of war against Puerto Rico in one form or another. And Cornelius Rhodes, I think, sort of exemplifies that a little bit.
Yeah, so I said that the, you know, overseas parts of the United States are often off stage from the perspective of the mainland. And what's important to grasp is that all kinds of things can happen off stage that couldn't happen under the glare of the spotlights. And the Cornelius Rhodes story is a great example of that. So Cornelius Rhodes is a doctor. He's Harvard trained. He's from the mainland, but he goes to San Juan. He goes to Puerto Rico, and he goes there to study anemia, a condition from which many Puerto Ricans suffer. And so what does he do? Well, suddenly, this, you know, when he hits the island, he just becomes a very different kind of doctor. So first of all, he intentionally refuses treatment to some of his patients just to see what will happen. He tries to induce disease in other of his patients also to see what will happen. He describes patients such as this to his colleagues as experimental animals. And then he writes a letter. He writes one of the most extraordinary letters that I've read as a historian, where he writes to a colleague, to a Boston colleague, and he, you know, starts off, it's a very chatty letter, and he said, you know, how are you? Hope everyone's well. Well, here's some gossip about the field. And then he says, oh, and me, Puerto Rico, you know, I'm in Puerto Rico. It's beautiful. The island is great. The only problem is the Puerto Ricans. They're awful. They're filthy. They steal. Frankly, they're the worst. And the best thing for Puerto Rico, he goes on to say, would be a total extermination of the population. And then he says, in fact, I've started it. I have killed 8 of my patients, and I've tried to transplant cancer. Turns out it's very hard to transplant cancer, but he doesn't know that. I've tried to transplant cancer into 13 others. You know, hope your wife's well, all best. And it's an incredible letter, right? Because he just confessed to, it seems like he's confessed to murdering 8 people. And extraordinarily, the letter gets found by the Puerto Rican hospital staff, and it becomes a major scandal in Puerto Rico. Of course it does. There's an investigation by the government. That investigation uncovers yet another letter, which the government, the governor describes as worse than the first, which is kind of impossible to imagine for me. But nevertheless, the government destroys that second letter, so we've never seen it as historians, and concludes that he wasn't really serious about what he said. He didn't really kill 8 people. And extraordinarily, Cornelius Rhodes is able to just leave. He doesn't face any kind of trial. He doesn't even lose his job. He just goes back to the mainland. What happens in San Juan stays in San Juan. And then his medical career takes off. Now, it does. I mean, what's amazing about the story is that in itself would be incredible, but it doesn't end because as his medical career takes off, he becomes the vice president of the New York Academy of Medicine. He goes into the army, and while he's in the army, he oversees he's the chief medical officer in a large scale series of tests of chemical weapons on U.S. service members. So U.S. service members have toxic agents applied to their skin to see what happens. Many of them suffer permanent damage. They're put in gas chambers with gas masks to see what will happen. Some of them are put out in jungles and told to fight while they're gassed from overhead. A lot of those people are also Puerto Rican. And Cornelius Rhodes is right there in the middle of it, writing up reports. Does black skin blister differently than white skin? Cornelius Rhodes will let you know. He gets a medal for this. And then as a result of those experiments, one of the things they figure out is that some of these toxic agents are actually good at fighting cancer. And Cornelius Rhodes uses that to become, in the third phase of his career, the first head of the Sloan Kettering Institute and basically one of the pioneers of chemotherapy. And that's what he's remembered for decades on the U.S. mainland, as a medical hero, the father of chemotherapy. And it really takes an extraordinarily long time before Puerto Ricans are able to get the message out that this guy who's been on the cover of Time magazine as a hero is actually the sort of like Mengele of Puerto Rico. And I mean, for me, that's kind of that's the final extraordinary bit, is that the informational segregation is so tight that it takes decades for Puerto Ricans to effectively, do something about the fact that Cornelius Rhodes is being openly celebrated as a hero on the mainland. And the people who are celebrating him have no idea what he was up to in Puerto Rico.
That story is just so nuts, but it really does capture. I mean, it is it's almost the perfect metaphor in some respects, right? I mean, that is the extraction or the oppression ends up, fueling on some level at different times the expansion and the success of the country in some fashion. And then we don't have too much time left here, but the nature of the empire changes to being less colonial and in many respects more like would you call it? Sort of via influence, or I mean, maybe the Hoover Scrooge story sort of is a good metaphor for this.
Yeah, so I think there are two things that happen. As the United States, gets through World War II, it becomes the most powerful country in the world. And it has the option militarily. I mean, it physically can do this. It has the option of doing what Britain had done, which is expressing its power by taking a lot of colonies and controlling a lot of the land of the planet. Right at the end of World War II, the United States actually has, in occupied zones mainly, and colonies, which is a slightly lesser number, it has more people who are under U.S. jurisdiction who are living outside of the mainland than who are living in all of the states. I mean, that's how much land the United States briefly controls at the end of World War II. And so then it faces an interesting question. Is it want to be Britain again? Does it want to sort of do that whole thing and claim colonies and annex Japan and all that kind of stuff? And it doesn't. And it still has a colonial empire. There are still five inhabited territories of the United States today, and millions of people live in them. But nevertheless, the United States sort of pivots away. One thing it does is it seeks to find ways to influence outside of its borders, to extend its and project power, not by extending its borders, by annexing new places, but by controlling processes in foreign countries. But undergirding that, and this is what I focus on particularly, is that the United States does this not by abjuring territory entirely, but by claiming just a bunch of small territorial points. And by a bunch, I mean literally hundreds. That's the number of foreign military bases that the United States has. But these points act as sort of staging grounds and beacons and just little sort of connectors that allow the United States to spread a much more diffuse influence out throughout the world, which is still undergirded by some sort of territorial component, but a territorial footprint that I think looks more pointillist than colonial.
I mean, it's almost like the web, like a series of servers. We have something like nearly 800 bases across the country. I mean, across the world.
Yeah, it's a network,
right? How does the influence there exclusively is it projecting power from a military standpoint? Like these are, we have the high ground in these 800 places, or we have control of, it need be, the harbor, or is it also a cultural one too?
Yes. What I think is so interesting about the bases is that their purpose is military. That's what they're there for. That's why we call them military bases. But that's not all they do, because you have to imagine these places as little, or in some cases actually not so little, enclaves that are full of people from the United States. And there's all kind of interesting contacts between people on the base, often who have quite a lot of money compared to the surrounding region, and the people around it. So in the book, I tell a story about the complicated interactions that people who are on base have with folks who are living in the shadow of the bases. And it actually becomes a really important vector for the spread of U.S. culture. So one of the questions I take up in my book is, why does Liverpool become this sort of world city of pop? Like, why is there so much? We know about the Beatles, but, you know, like the bench is like 500 bands deep. There's a lot of, you know, bands that like were pointed in the direction of the Beatles, you know, were doing that kind of music, and they're all coming out of the Liverpool area. And why is that? Because Liverpool hadn't habitually been the major city for pop music in Britain. And the answer is that, you know, Liverpool is in the shadow of the single largest U.S. Air Force base in Europe, this base called Burtonwood. And it's really clear that not just the Beatles, but all these other bands are kind of subsisting on, I mean, you know, these guys in the base who are very rich, who are going out into the clubs at night, who are demanding U.S.-style rock, and, you know, Ringo's stepdad works on the base, makes his money there, and gets all these records as a result of working there that he gives to Ringo. John's mom is what's called a good time girl, so I imagine she's spending some time with the guys from the bases. She also has an incredibly up-to-date record collection, and that's how Paul gets his records, too. And George sort of steals them from the local record shop, which is also bristling with all kinds of like really good, what they then called race records, which are African-American records of African-American music. And all of that's coming from the portal of the base, where there's just all this money, there's all this glamour, and there are all these guys sort of, you know, waiting to spread it around for willing young teenagers who can play U.S. style rock. So it's not entirely a surprise that the Liverpool area becomes an area sort of where rock takes off, because these bases are, you know, in some ways little just portals of the United States, and little portals not just of U.S. military power, but of U.S. You know, industrial standards and culture and all, you know, language and all these other things that come with the United States that seep through the portal as well.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. I wish we had more time to get to the standardization of screws, which I found fascinating. And longtime listeners of this program will remember the story of the Northern Mariana Islands and Jack Abramoff and Tom DeLay, and how they would visit that in the mid-aughts as a way of basically getting made in USA goods by basically near slave labor, practically. But there's a lot more in here. How to Hide an Empire, A History of the Greater United States. Daniel Immerwahr, thank you so much for your time today. We will put a link at majority.fm of your book.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure to be on.
All right, folks. We got to take a break, head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will have more fun. More fun than we really should be allowed to have. A close-up video of Seb Gorka talking to Michelle Bachmann. That's always fun. Also,
we have Ro Khanna fighting a coup.
Oh, is it? We do?
Some new sound coming.
Okay, great. We have, Joe Biden talking about his new slogan. We have, I don't know. I don't know if this is an interesting sort of misreporting on both Biden's support with minority voters and really sort of gender splits in donations coming from MSNBC. And, of course, Stephen Moore's last-ditch effort to argue that he is better than Herman Cain. All this and more.
Just overwhelmed by the ideas.
Yeah, can we play that drop? Just because we've contemplated one day coming into work and just instead of actually doing a show, just play this one clip from Dave Rubin over and over again.
I have to say that my brain is still in recovery mode from taking in so many high-level important ideas.
High-level.
I have to say that my brain is still in recovery mode from taking in so many high-level important ideas. I have to say that my brain is still in recovery mode from taking in so many high-level important ideas. I have to say that my brain is still in recovery mode from taking in so many high-level important ideas. I have to say that my brain is still in recovery mode from taking in so many high-level important ideas. I have to say that my brain is still in recovery.
There you go.
Same.
You know what?
It's almost better, though, when you can see his face, though, because he is saying this without any sense of, like, this is a weird thing to say.
Oh, he's taking it in.
He's
literally taking in so many.
That was prompted by a conversation he listened to between the Weinstein brothers. So,
how many times has he had the Weinstein brothers?
Literally,
how many times has he had those?
You know, Aaron Cohen.
These two guys who no one's ever heard of, like the greatest thinkers in the history of the world.
I don't know. Let me search my Rubin Report podcast feed.
Dave Rubin's gay. No, my mind's blown by so many high-level ideas.
Folks, just a reminder, you can support this program by becoming a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. And when you do, not only do you support the daily free show, but you also get extra content virtually every single day. You make this show possible. So if you've been thinking about joining, please do. And of course, if you do not have the financial means, but you want access to the fun half, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Wait an inordinately long period of time for us to go through the emails. It takes us a long time. But we will get there, and we will work out a deal for you, I promise. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Today is Tuesday. On Tuesdays, what happens is day turns into night, and then in Tuesday nights...
And then high-level ideas.
High-level ideas happen when your brain has recovered.
My brain has to recover from the Majority Report. Sorry, I can't take it. Tonight, Dr. Maitha Al-Hassan, we're talking about the uprisings in Algeria and the Sudan through the lens of Malcolm X and his relation to Africa, the Middle East, and liberation. Anna Kasparian is coming in studio, and we are going to dunk on Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg. Lula da Silva did a really important interview. We're going to talk about that. And, of course, the coup in Venezuela. So a ton of stuff tonight. And at 6 o'clock... as if that wasn't enough, a special live stream on the Spanish election results with Nando Vila on the Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel. So 6 and 7, Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel, patreon.com/TMBS for the whole thing. This weekend, an illicit history of humanitarian law.
Jamie, the Intifada?
This week on the Antifada, we have released the very first edition of a new side project called Prolet Cult that AP Andy is doing for our patrons. It's about UFOs, conspiracy theories, space news, and the paranormal, but from a Marxist perspective. So check that out if you're a patron, or this might be a good time to join. Also, Sean spoke with a guy from Means TV over the weekend. That's going to be out in our free episode later this week. And we still have our episode from last week where we talked to George Chicarello Marr about the coup in Venezuela, which seems very relevant in light of the news coming out of Venezuela now, and lots of other luminaries of the left. So check it out.
Matt?
On YouTube, episode 20 of Literary Hangover, Looking Back on the Spanish War, an essay by George Orwell, is available. For patrons, there's another essay on the same topic by the same guy. It's called Spilling the Spanish Beans by George Orwell when he was fresh from the Spanish Civil War, healing from his throat wound, and he was pissed off that he was called a Trotsky fascist in Spain, and he sort of explains what that's about.
Lots of ideas.
There's too many ideas in
Spain. Too many ideas. There's a lot of ideas in Spain, so it's kind of hard to keep track here of all the ideas. I don't know enough about Franco, but I do know that he's really into markets.
Franco?
Not getting into, the SJWs yeah, out of the schools.
Literally getting the SJWs out of the schools. What are your thoughts on Spanish leader Franco? I don't know. There's a lot coming at me
and
right
Jason now. And Jason and Trotsky. What was the deal with those two guys?
All right, we'll see you in the fun half. 646-257-3920.